Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Okay, welcome everyone to another one of our podcasts here on Eurosport. Usually I am with the normal suspects, Boris Becker here on my right. Thanks for coming, Boris. John McEnroe. Today we're joined by Ivan Lendl. And do you know why?
Who would have thought?
Yes. Why are you invited? You want to know why?
I have no idea.
Because you have a positive head-to-head against all three of us.
I like
and
that.
We're giving you a wild card. So welcome.
Thank you.
Everything goes here. Okay, that's the first thing.
Okay.
We're sitting in the Players' Garden. It might be noisy. This place is noisy. So my first question is going to go to you, John. Not because you're the oldest, but because you're from New York City.
Okay.
What is it about the U.S. Open that you just love? Is it the crowd? Is it the noise? What is it for you? Don't like?
No, I like all of it. But, you know, I'm biased, obviously. To me, New York's the best city in the world. And does anyone disagree with that? And it brings an energy, and I think it brings things sometimes good, sometimes bad, out of players and people that otherwise you wouldn't see at the other events. And you have to deal with factors you don't have to deal with at other places, the noise being one of them. So does anyone disagree with me on that?
Ivan, what did you not like about the U.S. Open early on and then got to like?
He got this 8 straight finals. He must have liked it okay.
I liked it okay. I liked the fact that I got to stay at home in Greenwich every second day. I came here once to test the court before the tournament and then only for my matches. And I was able to practice at home, and I think it has helped me a lot to be fresher because, as John said, it's quite hectic over here and it wears out on you. And I was dealing only with half of it as opposed to the other players.
Boris,
I had to fall in love with New York to eventually play well. You know, being born and raised in Germany, European bred,
I'm like with you.
The calmness of London, the beauty of Paris, even though I never won there. So coming over here, I'd like to go out and have a good time in Manhattan and, you know, meet cool people, but I couldn't really concentrate. So I had to actually go on the island and stay with my good friend Dino for me to finally come through and win my only US Open.
And you know also, Mats, that here was where they started the night matches. It's actually at Forest Hills in 1975, but I think that's added an extra element that you see now, even a couple times at Wimbledon when they played later, that's been somewhat awesome, I know. And I don't know, I think Paris is going to start having night matches,
too. I think so.
I love the night matches.
1975?
75 was when it started at Forest Hills.
Really? How about indoors at that time? Did they play night matches? You're a lot older than me, so you probably know.
I didn't know you had a sense of humor. Let's see.
I bought one on the way here.
I think that there was... What was your question again? I lost track.
Indoor night matches.
Indoor night matches. Are you talking about at the majors?
No. Just indoors.
Oh, indoors. Yeah, I'm talking... Of course they had indoor night matches. We used to do that at the Garden. But, I mean, that doesn't mean... Listen, I'd like playing at night. I prefer that. So you probably wanted to get it over with so you could go play some golf.
I hated playing at night. I didn't see well at night, and I just disliked it. It threw me off.
You know, Borg hated it, and, you know, he felt like it cost him. And his buddy, Leonard Berglin, God rest his soul, would always complain bitterly that he'd have to go play the night matches. And you? What about you?
Then? I fell in love with my wife here. After leaving Louis Armstrong in 1985, I walked into her. I walked into a friend of hers, and he wanted to talk to me. And I said, I got to go, man. I got to go. Do you want an autograph or something? We didn't take selfies in those days.
His name wasn't Marlon.
Yes, it was. Marlon. And then he realized I was leaving, and he said, well, she also wants to meet you, which is not true. And I saw her and I said, oh my God, should we meet later too? So I fell in love with my wife. We're still married and I am with you, Boris. I needed that to actually love playing at the US Open. But because you're new, Yvonne, I'm going to ask you a little bit of a sensitive question maybe, because you play the US Open is in kind of the Cold War era with Russia and America, sort of Jimmy Carter, that kind. We had Johnny Mack, we had Jimmy Connors, and then you. And you were most probably looked upon as something somewhat evil to the New York fans. How did you react?
Ivan Drago, how did you react to the fans?
You on two fronts. Number one, I don't know what my connection with Russia is.
I'm just saying you okay. were a communist country. Yeah. In America, they didn't
care. Number two, Jimmy Carter left office in January 1980 and Ronald Reagan was in when I played.
Yes, no, I agree. But you get my point, where there was a little bit of that. Where you were the Eastern guy and they were rooting for them. Yeah. How did you deal
with that? Did you embrace that?
I didn't really...
Did you hate that?
No, I didn't mind it one way or the other. My philosophy was, if I play and they root for me, I have to play hard so I don't let them down.
Yes.
If I play and they root against me, I play even harder to piss them off.
That's
That's a good attitude.
I like that.
That's fair and straight. That's how you always came across. I mean, it looked like you were pretty unemotional. You were not faced so much with the situation. Obviously, you are a human being. You do have a heart. I've seen it. But
you have a heart. Imagine somebody tells you can't do it, and then you do it. You look at them and you can flip them a finger.
Yeah, absolutely. But Boris, the question for you is pretty obvious now, because in the most complimentary way that I can possibly put this, you were looking at two monsters over here for different reasons. The best hands in tennis in Johnny Mack, the most probably driven and most professional early on in Ivan. Yeah. And then you're growing up watching this. And how did you deal with that? You came and you won Wimbledon at 17 and you won Wimbledon at 18. How did you overcome this kind of caliber of players and attitude early in your career?
Well, difficult, you know. John and Ivan, the big personalities, on and off the court, you know. Don't think they're, you know, the pretty boys inside the locker room.
Did they talk to you in the locker room at all?
That's where I've been called pretty boys.
No, they have their you know, group of people. They have a demanding presence inside the locker room. And there comes young, you know, freckled Boris and didn't know, you know, which corner do I belong. So I think we had a situation on the court in Milan for the first time when you beat me, where you were a little bit, you know, rough with me, and it was in the locker room. And
John then, being rough with someone?
Well, no, he had a few comments, and then maybe to intimidate me, I don't know.
Do you remember what I said to you in Milan locker room after the match?
It's not child-friendly. It's not child-friendly.
No, it is child-friendly.
No, actually, actually, it was good. It was good what you told me. Yes, after the match.
Yeah, I said, you know, win something. Yeah. If you're going to complain, win something first. Then you won Wimbledon and Queens 4 months later at 17.
John, who did you lose to at Wimbledon in 1985?
It wasn't Bars.
No, I know that, but who did you lose
to? I lost to a guy by the name of, you may remember him, Kevin Curran.
And you lost to him in the semis? Or?
I lost to him in the quarters.
Quarters, okay.
Yeah.
That's right. Kevin Curran beat Jimmy Connors in the semis.
I lost to Henri Lecomte in round of 16.
So we both had bad years.
Is that the reason why I'm winning?
No. I'm just
waiting.
I lost in the first round, if anyone cares.
Where I'm heading, Boris, is that... John then took sabbatical after the US Open for 6 months, and then he came back, but in my opinion he never played as well as before. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that,
and
unfortunately.
So therefore you really didn't get
the best of John.
That's true.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you, Yvonne. Thank you.
We actually never
Look at this relationship.
We never played in a major. Oh no, you did beat me.
We played once in a major. That was one of the few times I did beat you at Australian Open.
That's right.
The year after
won
it.
That's right.
My last year on the tour in 92.
That's right. But I'm just coming back.
I wish we had played at Wimbledon.
Yeah. You know. Or the Open.
Would have loved to play this
But I'm saying, you know, you were a big presence in the locker room as well. And then I think nowadays, just to compare it to stay relevant, I think, you know, when Rafa comes to the locker room, Roger, and you know, they have their, you know, three or four people around them, and there's the locker room gets a bit silent. You know, nobody jokes too much. That was very much when you guys were around, including you. So me, by far the youngest in the locker room, I had to find my corner first to be accepted. And the easiest way to do so was winning you guys on the tennis court, beating you.
You have to gain respect.
Yes, that's right.
That's all.
Yeah, that's
it shouldn't be given. You should earn it. But, you know,
and that's the problem with today's players, yeah, right? They haven't really earned it.
I was hoping you would say that.
They haven't really earned it.
You know, they, some have more than others. But what I wanted to say was it's too bad we can't have a time capsule. Because it would be interesting to see how John deals with the ball, which is coming now fast with topspin under your feet, and how the other guys, as I was saying 2 months earlier, John was the only guy who could have a volley at the shoelaces or half volley and put it away with pace.
Yeah.
I never met anyone like that or never played anyone like that. How would that look today? I would love to see that. That would be very interesting.
I would have loved to seen it too.
Yeah.
How do you think it would have played?
I think you would have trouble with pace because you had trouble with my pace, but I also think you would have adjusted.
Don't you think I would have been able to have, because your pace was, I would say, compared to today's game, as you would have been as big a hitter as there was in the game. You're one of the biggest hitters in the game, like Boris.
Like Boris, yeah.
Also.
Yeah. Yep.
And so if you grew up with that, it's easier to learn how to handle it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I agree. And, you know, it was like when Pete came and he was serving so big, all of a sudden, 5 years later, there were eight other guys serving like that and everybody got used to the pace and Pete had trouble.
What do you think that your mindset would have been if you played today? Because when I think of it myself, I don't know if I could have been a great player if I had to take risks as often as they do today, the players. I mean, I know Novak doesn't make too many mistakes, but he does take risks at some point. And I never took any risks at all, maybe coming to the net. How would you guys, Boris, I start with you, do you think your mind would have been able to adjust to the kind of tennis they're playing today?
Look, I think, you know, without beating around the bush, we have four champions sitting here, and I think we would have all adapted
right,
to
that's
anybody
for sure. Yeah.
At any generation, and we would have adapted to the space, we would have changed the rackets, because it's different when you have it in your DNA, and I think we would have taken on the challenge. Now, even you know, being Mr. Slopley and everything, you adapted your game to get along with this guy at the final of the US Open. I remember you came a lot more to the net than you've ever done before in order to win. I think the bottom line, you adjust to the competition across the net and you would find a way to win.
Let me ask you a question, Ivan, because you were the first guy that started changing rackets, you know, and getting new string job every 7 to 9 games. So how did that come about? Because now everyone's doing it.
Well, I felt that the tension goes down as you
that
play with it.
That quickly.
That quickly.
Within 20
minutes,
30 minutes.
We could prove that.
Yeah.
And so when you get new balls, you just stay in the same conditions. As the tension goes down, the balls slow down and they relatively go the same way. Then if you keep that racket and you get new balls, they just fly. So why not just keep constantly the same thing? And the other reason was I was playing with a thin, natural, uncoated gut, and they were not going to last much more than 9 games.
Let me ask you another question then.
You have a lot of questions.
Why did you then, if you went, reasoning would be, because I remember that you when we went and played some matches, exhibition matches, but I know you told me this, in altitude or different conditions, whatever they were, you always played with the same tension. Why wouldn't you change and go tighter, for example, if you're playing in 6,000 feet?
Rafa does that too, doesn't he? I think Rafa plays with the same tension.
I think no matter what. With the same tension, not all the time, but I played at 72.5 pounds. But I played a few Wimbledons when I lost to Boris in Wimbledon. I played at 55 pounds.
Really?
Because it helped serve and volley. But I wasn't as good returning. But the reason I didn't do that is because we didn't have stringers traveling with us and I wasn't willing to string on the road because you twist that natural gut without any coating on it a little bit and it pops in the second point and I will run out of rackets before we even start. So Warren Bosworth, who was a genius with that, just strung all my rackets on the same machine.
Do you sort of wish that you would be able to play with the strings they utilize now that provide all this?
I would love that.
It'd be interesting, right?
Because it makes such a big
I bet
game.
You can hit it so
hit.
Hard and it doesn't
you
go
on
long.
It, yeah. It dips in.
You know, when I stepped away from the game when the kids were growing up and I traveled with them around the country for golf and so on and so on. And then I came here a few times for some matches and I see the ball flying the first match. And I stopped watching. And all of a sudden, I realized they're still playing the point. It was going 4 feet long, right. And all of a sudden, the ball dropped. And I think that's also why we don't see the guy serving and volleying a lot, because the ball is so difficult to track down at the net.
Absolutely. If you had to pick one player that you think plays the most similar game to you, that sort of watched you in today's game, I'll tell you who. I look at Shapovalov. To me, like, that's how I would have played.
My left hand is useless.
I didn't think Shapovalov would be your pick, but if you had to pick one player now that you say, God, that guy plays like I do, or that's how I would have played.
Right?
I would have played like, yeah.
I think I played more under control than Dennis does. I think Dennis.
No, I'm not saying Dennis. I'm saying I did.
Oh, you did.
You would. Dennis.
For you or for me?
For me. No, I'm asking you. I'm saying for me it would be Dennis.
For me it would be Andy Murray. I think I would play
for
like
you.
Andy
yes,
Murray.
Yes, yes, I agree with that. I agree with
that.
Like
and I'm going to ask Boris the same question. But who do you think, you know, plays the most like you now, or who you would play most like?
We talked about it today. a little bit. It's kind of hard to tell because
a lot of players play like you. The truth be known, you know, you changed this game, man.
Yeah, but we're talking 30 years ago. Come on.
But I'm saying you served.
Can you still remember that?
It was 30 years ago today. I lost to Yvonne again.
More than 30 years ago, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Who do you think? You want to think about it, Yvonne.
Oh, what about you,
Boris? I thought about it. I can't come up with a...
No, you said Novak and Rafa, a combination.
Combination of Novak and Rafa, a little more aggressive than Novak, hit it harder and so on. Obviously, don't move as well as he did. But...
Bigger serve.
I think the way for me to play would be like Novak, don't give anything. And when I see that green or even orange light, just let it go.
Yeah.
And go forward, finish it. I would have to go forward more to finish it.
Boris, what about you,
I think
Boris?
All our styles were very particular, and I have a hard time thinking about who would be most likely in his attitude. But obviously, I keep my mouth shut.
I look at you, and I'm thinking of Kyrgios.
I was just going to say. No, honestly.
They behave similarly.
No, I'm talking about how he sets up the points with the quick points to serve, the forehand, trying to keep the points short and everything, getting the crowd involved, but obviously keeping my mouth shut a lot longer than he does. But that mentality was similar to mine.
You serious?
Yeah.
I don't see
anybody else like that. Like, you know, the way I've played, the way I felt on the court, the way I would draw attention from the audience. I liked it a lot.
What about Tsitsipas? He's slumping now, but he sort of had that emotion diving
True, but I feel he doesn't.
To me, that's closer than
not,
Nick.
Not as explosive, not right. as dangerous. I find Nick on a good night dangerous to watch, you know, for himself and everybody else. And with Stefanos is a bit more, maybe in a couple of years. I find the serve, he could do a lot more. He could play bigger. The moment, my taste, he rallies too far from the baseline and gets in too many long matches. I hated that.
I went in a lot more than Shapovalov does. But I think, as Yvonne said, it's harder to get to net.
Yeah.
You know, the ball's being hit so hard. There's so much spin on it.
If you come to the net and the guy takes a swing at it, you're toast.
Because it spins so much.
It spins so much, and they can create angle, and they all have good ground strokes. Mm. If you can get to the net where the guy blocks, I think you're good.
We had an interesting, somebody came up to me and said that they're doing a research on how good the guys are returning today. Obviously talking mainly about Novak. He's talking about the three big, Roger, Novak, and Rafa. And I thought that the servers were better in the past. I thought that somebody like Sampras, Boris, Goran Ivanišević, today they serve hard, but I'm not sure that they're great servers, whereas those guys were great servers. Who's a great server today? Roger Federer is a great server to me.
Roger is
but
amazing.
What do you
he
guys think of
spots.
That? They're hitting them harder, but I don't necessarily see them serving better.
I was doing it for the last 4 years where I was going through statistics and looking at all these things, and Roger hits amazing, amazing spots on his serve.
So are they better servers than, let's say, John, and you are a great server? These guys were exceptional servers. They backed up their serves in a different way. It was harder to return
in those days. I never thought of John as an exceptional server.
No.
But what I thought John was better than anyone else is backing up that serve with his play after that.
But that's what
there were better serves if you isolate the serve.
But they based the statistics on breaking serve and not putting returns.
Yeah, exactly. But if you isolate the serve, I can come up with better servers.
Sure.
But to support it, and I think I fall into that category too, that I supported it and won a high percentage of my first serve points and servings games. Yeah,
I think they've given up a little bit on the serve because of these strings. I think either that or they don't spend enough time trying to hit their spots.
I think it's an underestimated shot nowadays. The game.
I
don't think they practice it enough. I think they play too many baseline rallies, too many ground strokes. They all forget that they start every game or every other game with their serve. You have a big server like Isner. He lives and dies on his serve. You can say that's a great serve. But then you have so many others who could, you know, serve a lot bigger and win the service game a lot easier, but they don't somehow back it up with the rest of their game.
Let me ask you this, guys, with the strings. Is it possible that the strings are a little inconsistent right now? Because what I see is the guys not hitting their spots on the serve as much as John was saying. And what I also see is them not being consistent with the depth of their shots.
That I see too. I see that.
Is it possible that it's because of the string and they're afraid that every now and then it just flies a couple feet longer?
I think it's more probable that it's the mentality of the player himself and the effort that's put in, as opposed to the, certainly on the ground strokes.
Because they hit it so hard.
They're taking such big swings that it's tougher to be as precise as consistently.
Right. But with so much spin, the ball drops shorter. Yeah. And if you look at who hits the ball deepest in the world right now in men's tennis, to me it's Novak.
Novak.
Who returns the deepest in men's tennis? Novak. Who is the best player in the world? Novak. Who is the best returner in the world? Novak. Mm-hmm. So the depth has a lot to do with it. And
it's key in the rallies. I mean, when you set up the point, it's always
Last night when he was hurting and all that, he was so deep. I'm just falling asleep watching that. I'm saying, Jesus, is he hitting it deep? And I think the depth is one thing which the younger players don't appreciate or maybe don't understand enough.
I don't think a lot of young players have an idea how to structure a point. They hit the ball hard, they hit it down the middle, but only much later in their career when they fell down a couple of times, they understand there's no luck in winning. Otherwise, Roger, Rafa, Novak will be lucky for 15 years, right? So there's a structure to it. There's a system to winning. There's a preparation for winning. And I think that's the problem with the young up-and-comings. They come in quickly, and they actually don't know why they're winning.
I want to ask Yvonne something. Now, do you think these three guys, because I call them the three best ever, do you believe that's an accurate statement, or do you disagree with that? Because to me, they look at us, and, you know, we're like, well, it's we don't quite size it up, and I mean, are they as good? Do you believe they're as good as I believe they are?
I can make an argument that, first of all, I think there were few eras which you could make best ever. I think in the 60s, when you had the Australians, I mean, it was an exceptional time in tennis.
Laver,
Roswell, Newcomb, those guys.
Okay.
That was exceptional time in tennis. I don't think in our era was too bad.
I think
Andre and Pete did quite well. And I think these guys are something special. Am I prepared to say they're the best? No, I'm not, because you can't compare the Australians in the amateur era. You have MO in there. You can't compare the amateur era to professional era. They're the best since 1968, since the French Open 1968. No doubt about it. I can make an argument that they're the best, and that's why the young generation can't catch up. Or I could make another argument saying, you know, they're very good, but the young generation is weak. I can make both arguments and make them stand up.
I idolize Rod Laver. I try to play like him. He was about 5'9". You know,
He still is.
I think he's about 5'7" now.
Okay.
But and then you look at Roger Federer. He was the guy that's most comparable to Rod.
Right.
Now, he's 6'1". It's hard to stand up to that, you know, to me, just, you know, physically, that he could make that transition with these guys as much as I love Rod Laver. Rod Laver. He's a taller version.
John, if you're comparing how those guys would do against today's guys, you can't. Let's look at track and field. Let's look at swimming. And we're going to see how the times have improved. And you can't compare 40 years ago, 30 years ago, even 10 years ago. There is very few records which stand in track and field which are older than 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
Okay?
Bob Beamon stood for a long time.
So you can't compare that.
Long jump.
And you have to And even that has been beaten now.
Yeah, now it
has. Took a while.
And it was in Mexico City and so on and so on.
Yep.
So you can't compare it performance-wise. You can compare it how they work in their time to their opponents.
Look, there's 28 majors sitting on this table.
That's right.
8776.
28, and okay. There's 225 years as well.
I didn't want to mention that much.
I'm glad you did the math.
And just referring Thanks to for your question, the greatest of all time. What I miss is more of a competition with these three. I'm with you. I think it's an unbelievable time. You know, obviously,
yeah,
Roger standing arm and Rafa and Novak is catching up quickly. So that's unique. But where's the rest? And my question is always, are these three so much better? Or is the rest not as good?
And that's what I said. I can make both arguments.
Correct. Yeah. And I'd like to see
Zverev,
Tsitsipas, you know, the young generations picking it up more. But sometimes I don't see the mentality. I don't see the fight. You would have gone crazy, probably all of us, with any of the top three. In one way or another, you would found a way. And that's what I'm missing a little bit. The acceptance of losing is far greater now than it was in our days.
You have an insight that we don't have, because you not only work with Murray, who tried to battle these three guys and successfully with your help, reasonably successfully, and then you just work with for a year or so, I believe, with Sasha Zverev. What, you know, because that comes to what Boris just said. Is it a mental thing, or is he just not as good, or what happened there? What's happening, I should, say. Because he seems like a great kid.
I was talking earlier about golf. There are three young players right now. Wolf, Morikawa, and Hovland. They all finished college or stopped college this year. Went on the tour, and in 2 months, Morikawa and Wolf won on PGA Tour, and Hovland had top five finishes in six events or something crazy like that. He just finished second last week to get his tour card.
Who?
Victor Hovland.
Victor Hovland.
He's a Norwegian.
Norwegian.
That's a good
player. And they're all potentially great.
Okay.
Now, everybody's talking them up, and we're talking down the tennis guys. But you know, when you think about it, it's a bit unfair to the young tennis guys, because they have won on the same level these guys have won. They won on the ATP Tour. They won the Masters. They won
the
1000.
The world.
And
the
they
world.
Have not won in the major.
Right.
Neither have those three guys, and yet everybody is building them up. So are we maybe a little too harsh? Maybe they're 22, 21 years
what I'm
old.
Asking.
Should we wait with our judgment till they're 25 or 26? Because today's 33 is ours 27.
Yeah.
The times have
That's
moved.
That's true. That's
and
a good point.
So now, before I condemn those guys, I would like to see them, and Roger challenged them the other day, I would like to see them be challenging those guys more.
Before they quit. Challenge them.
Yeah, but, nice.
You know, is it my fault that Borg quit and I couldn't challenge him because I was just coming up? It's not Boris's fault he couldn't challenge you because you were already sliding a little bit. So you can't blame anyone for winning when they don't have competition, because it's not their fault.
But I find it extraordinary that, you know, exceptions, one or two, none of these young has made a semifinal. Or, you know, nobody...
Tsitsipas has...
Did he or didn't he? No, in Melbourne.
That's the opposite argument, though. Wait a second, because he just said... You know, I was sliding. True, that Boris didn't get a chance. But these young guys have a chance to challenge them when they're playing amazing still.
I agree. And, you know,
and they
we
should
can
be
make
inspired
arguments.
And get better quicker.
You know, there is one factor which is undefeated in tennis, and that's father time. And it's going to catch up with these guys. And Roger is certainly giving father time great run for his money.
Yeah. Sure is.
And so is Rafa, and so is Novak. And hopefully Andy will come back strong, and he will do that as well. I don't know if he will or not. He's certainly trying, but there will be a time. And then are we going to say these young guys started winning because they got better, or did they start winning by default?
Well, that's the worry.
Exactly.
That's the worry.
Or is it going to be five of them, or is one just going to step up, dominate for a while?
No, but
the interest level won't be the same, in my opinion, because they're not challenging them enough. And then they'll come along when these three guys go away.
Yeah, but then you have one of them win two majors in a year, or maybe three majors in a year, and all of a sudden
it
will change in a hurry.
That's true. Yeah.
True. I just hope it happens within the next 18 months, because I think
I hope
frame,
it happens last
Russia,
two
Rafa
years.
Novak
but
still,
it didn't.
It's still, but I again, I think it's a different attitude. You know, when the four of us, we went to a major, a semi-final was the expectancy, wasn't it? Yeah. I mean, a semi-final...
It was a bad tournament.
That was sort of, okay, that's the minimum.
Bad tournament.
Nowadays, they're screaming, reaching the second week.
Different...
I mean, I wouldn't even make a post about reaching the second week. And now, up into the second...
Quarterfinals seem to be too big a deal these days. I agree with that.
That's too... The low expectations is for me...
Okay, let me ask you this then, Boris. You get thumped so long by these three. Then all of a sudden you beat one of them and make a semis. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Because they just beat you into a pulp for a long time and you just have no confidence against them. Yeah.
So example, Tsitsipas. He beats Federer in a magical match in Melbourne. He reaches the semis. Great kid. Wonderful. You know, French Open was good. First round Wimbledon, first round the Open. Boom. What happened?
I think expectations pressure. Because he had some success and now it's expected and he hasn't dealt with it yet.
Okay, but isn't that wasn't that our norm? But I mean, weren't we our own worst critics of saying a quarterfinal was a shitty tournament?
I always said pressure is self-inflicted.
Yeah.
Because I absolutely don't give a flip what anybody thinks, but I do know what my expectations of myself are.
There's a
sure, you had high expectations.
Yeah.
But and you put plenty of pressure on yourself. Something tells me.
Yeah. Yes, but it's self-inflicted.
Well, either way, it's pressure.
But if you don't have to answer to anyone because you don't really care, or you maybe don't care is the wrong word, but that you answer to yourself the most, the rest doesn't matter that much.
Yeah.
What do they write? Doesn't matter that much. I have my expectations and I have to answer to myself.
When you got criticized or when people said you weren't emotional, did that you didn't care about that?
Too bad.
Too bad? you didn't care?
No.
Yeah. Did you?
Never care.
Yeah. I love it. Love it. But there's another
totally
point.
I believe you. I totally
but
there, believe
but there's
you.
Another point that we're going to actually, we're going to only
he
talk about your...
better because he's the neighbor.
Yeah. The neighbor so for the Germans, you know, and the Czechs.
Very close. Think. Very close neighbors and so
and
on.
My
so
mother was actually Czech. Yes.
Yeah, she was from Novichin.
Yes.
You see, you can learn something from me every day.
But there's one point.
We're not doing this tomorrow, then.
I want to raise one point, though, that's completely different, and that has to do with what we're talking about, is that when I came up as a 17-year-old, I felt straight away I can play with the hard court and the grass court specialist, the best in the world, on a slow clay court. So I build up a little bit of confidence by beating some of the hardcourt players and the grasscourt players early in my career, even if they're one or two or whatever their ranking was. So suddenly we have that. Today, they can't do that because the surfaces and the matchups seem to be too similar. Depending, doesn't matter what if it's grass or clay, the tactical matchups seem to be very similar. And in our generation, that wasn't the case. It was a complete opposite playing you on a grass
surfaces,
court
yeah.
or you on a clay
Everything's
court.
Everything's very homogenized now.
Yeah, and that, I think, makes a big difference for these young guys. If you lose to Federer on clay, you're going to lose to him on every surface.
I bet you never thought you'd see the time where at Wimbledon you'd see all the male players serving and staying back.
Well, I get a kick out of it second week when I see where the court is worn out.
Yeah, exactly. I never in my wildest dreams
I would be wearing
that.
My clay court shoes there.
Unbelievable.
After watching Rafter play Ivan Ivanišević in that classic Wimbledon final, and the next year, Hewitt plays Nalbandian, and they don't serve in volley once.
Is that correct?
Yes,
is that a fact?
Yeah, I believe. I believe so. I mean,
I have a question regarding
not one time
coaches, and I benefited early in my career of being surrounded by really good coaches. They made me a better player. I think the same for you. And for everybody, what about the great coaches of today? I consider you one of the best. You all, if you wanted to, were the same. You know, I do my best. So what about there are so many new coaches in the locker room. Are they really telling these young players something they haven't heard yet? It's a bit of a question here.
I'm not sure I understand what you're asking.
The answer is,
I think there's a lack of experience in the coaching these days compared to maybe in the past a little bit, and we didn't all have coaches
in
the same way.
You know,
there's a lot of floating around coaches.
Coach, by the way.
Yeah, you didn't really have one.
Not a coach that I travel with.
You were uncoachable, maybe.
Well, that's another issue.
But I think you had a good coach as a kid, Tony Palafox.
Oh, no, he was great. He taught me so
well. And I had good coaches as a kid. And when I went to coach, and then I had a great coach in Tony Roach, and had a very good coach in Feedback. and so on. And
we had good coaches today. That's my point.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that I was fortunate to learn from all of them, whether it was my PV coach, beginner coach, or at under 14, under 18, then Feebak, then Roach. I learned from all of them, and I was able to draw on that experience when I started coaching. Mm. So if some players don't have that fortune that they have been coached by that many great coaches or good people, they really don't have that experience, and they don't have who to draw on.
Mm, isn't that the problem with the younger generation? That's really my question, because unless you've really been through the mill in a Grand Slam, you don't know what it's like. It doesn't matter how many books you read, doesn't matter how many videos you've seen, unless you've been into the second week of a major, the craziness starts, yeah. The locker room gets empty, the pressure, you know, self-inflicted yeah. or not, unless you've been there yourself, it's very difficult to advise that young man or woman what it's like.
That's why I felt fortunate to have Tony Roach, who played all four majors finals, because he knew how you feel. He knew how difficult it is to get something to eat into you in the morning. And he knew also that you have to do it. And he knew when to talk, and he knew when to keep quiet. You know, I never liked playing Stefan Edberg. And we're driving here in 1986 for the match, and I'm going to play Stefan at 11, and you played the match here after us. And I was nervous because didn't set
the
well for me.
Kick serve on your backhand, it didn't like so much.
Yeah. And hitting backhands up here is not easy for a single-hander. And I say, what do you think, Tony? He goes, you will be all right, mate. Don't worry about it. Just play, and if you're in little doubt, be more aggressive.
Yeah. Not too complicated.
Very simple.
Yeah, simple.
Very simple.
It seems like the players, they have a lot of the young players, especially, they have their family around them, which I think makes, you know, it can be good in a way, but it can be a little bit too much to me, coaching them and even managing them.
Meaning mother and fathers becoming coaches and agents.
Yes.
Overprotective.
Experience in the coach, having been there, you can't pay enough money for that.
No.
Yeah. That's what I think.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, if I were playing today and know what I know today, I would hire any of you, no problem, even if you haven't coached before, because you have the experience. I don't need you to tell me how to play tennis. No. I know how to play tennis. I need you to guide me through the most extreme pressure.
Agree. We're going to soon cut this off, and I'm going to just ask about the head-to-head between the two of you guys, because it has a little bit to do with coaching. We know with Nadal and Djokovic, they played each other about 51, 52 times. It's very even. But there's a strange pattern where one player wins five in a row, the next player wins five in a row. And I was looking through our rivalries, really. We only played 10 times. I don't have this with you guys. I don't have a good rivalry with either of the three of you, actually, in head-to-head. But you two have been pretty interesting, I have
36.
To say. Yeah, you played 36 times. You know that. You're ahead by a few.
21-15.
But he won
we
when
both
you guys were sort of a little bit, when both of you
I forgot
were more
who has
in the prime,
the better one.
When both of you were more in the prime, I feel like John won maybe a little bit more than you played for longer than
we
him
had
time. But anyway.
He beat me when I was over the hill.
That's it, exactly. You were over the hill at a pretty young age too, John, just like me.
Interesting waves.
That's and I'm going to ask you about
it. I was beating John Early.
Okay, hold on one second. Hold on.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. 81.
Okay, hold on. John won the first two times.
Right.
Okay, John
won the next seven.
In Milan and the US Open. And then suddenly you win an 81 in Roland Garros in the quarterfinals, three sets, and you win six in a row.
Yeah.
What did you figure out just by beating him on clay? Well, what did you figure out on the other surfaces?
I didn't figure out anything. I would like to know what John figured out then in 83 and 84.
Well, that's coming next. That's coming next.
He was stamping me. And I was trying to deal with it, problem solving.
Yeah.
So I started watching tapes from 1981.
Okay.
And I stopped in one set. I said, neither one of these two guys on the tape can beat any of the guys playing today, 2 years later. Okay. That's how much the game has moved forward.
Okay.
So then I figured out what I need to do to beat John, because I was sick and tired of being 2 and 3 in the world. And I figured out what I need to
beat. What was that? What
did you need I needed to come in forward more, so you didn't feel comfortable just massaging the ball and coming on your terms. I wanted you to come in on some of the orange lights. And I needed to improve my second serve so you don't come in on that and be successful.
Interesting.
Okay. Interesting. So forwards, 1983, US Pro Indoors, Philadelphia. You suddenly turn it around, John, and then you won 8 out of the next 9. And I have a feeling this is when you changed rackets, maybe? to the little bit bigger? Was that an 83?
Yeah, I did switch to the 200G, the graphite one in 83. But you know what's funny?
What were you?
Don Budge came up to me right before I played Yvonne, and he said and I'd lost like 6 or 7 in a row, and he said, "Listen, you got to take away his angle on the passing shots. You got to try to come up the middle." When you move in, and you know, don't give him an angle.
Is that when it goes in your chest?
What's that?
From the middle, it goes in your chest.
I got plenty in the chest. I was willing to accept a couple in the chest in order to get the occasional win.
You didn't look happy about it.
So I said, you know something, I wasn't happy about it. but you got to accept it, you know. And funnily enough, I said, what the hell? I've lost a bunch in a row. I'm going to do that.
Yeah,
and
it worked. Something different, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, might as well.
And it worked straight away.
And by the way, I took time off when I was 27 in 1986 when I had my first kid. I took 6 months off. Yeah. The plan
I thought
was,
it was after the Open here in 85.
Well, it was. You know, I stopped playing in February because I kept playing till the end of the year. Yeah.
And then we played an exhibition in L.A. when you were coming back, first match back. We played EXO at the Forum. You had a match point, and I happened to squeak out a match.
But who would remember that?
And
you know, the plan was to come back the way these other guys and become a better player. Right. I wasn't planning to become a worse player. No. I just want to say that for the record.
Sure,
I wanted to get better. You know, I wish I had. I got a little slower.
Yeah. In 83 and 84, especially in 84, I think that was John's best year.
No, he lost only 2 matches, one to you in the French Open,
one
and the
to
other
Vijay.
I lost a match in the Davis Cup, and I lost to Vijay in Cincinnati.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but
to Vijay?
I peaked in 84.
Yeah, but he played. That was partially because in 83 he started getting better somehow, whether it was the racket or something else, but his tennis has improved, and I had to catch up to it again.
Yeah, exactly. And it nearly lasted all the way through the French Open final in 84. Yeah. Seriously.
Well, it lasted after that. Yeah. I continued to play well.
What I mean, it lasted. You nearly got him on clay.
It lost the next year when I lost in the finals in 85 here. When I beat him 2 weeks in a row.
You beat him in 84 here.
No, in 85. Yeah, and we played in the finals the next year.
Right.
That was one of the matches where I got into a zone. We were talking about zones earlier. That was one of the matches. But
ball as hard as he could. Is that fair to say?
You had 5-2 set point on my serve. I passed you. And then I won 6-3 and 4, and I felt like I was floating on the court.
And you were just crushing the ball.
Yes.
Remember everything. I don't remember anything.
I remember breaking
just
at 4-0.
Just cut that part out, okay?
I remember breaking at 4-0 in the third. You hit a volley to my forehand and a running lob with a forehand.
I don't remember that.
I remember match point too, John.
Oh, God.
Guys, you
have to remember your first U.S. Open match point. Come on.
No, let me
tell
think.
Tell
I,
me
I
you don't remember your
no,
first
I do remember
U.S. Open
it. You're right,
match
I do remember.
Okay, there you
okay,
go.
I do remember.
It's just unfortunate. For
what
you.
Happened on the match point, okay?
We don't need to go about it. I know what it was, but I'm going to say...
Was it a double fault?
No. It was on my serve.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I couldn't break you. Yeah.
But I will say one other thing about the record, 21 and 15. Now that John plays golf, there has been some talk about us possibly playing together through the through a common friend. However, I would love to improve my record.
Now, okay, so then the follow-up question, would you be willing to take strokes from him?
Yes.
Wait. You asked the wrong guy. You have to ask me first. Would I be willing to offer strokes?
Yes.
No effing way.
What's your handicap now?
It's 1 now.
1?
I got back to 1, yeah.
Oh, are you good. Still hitting the chip with the left hand?
Right hand. I play left-handed and I chip right-handed.
Oh, the chip right-handed.
He's chipping right-handed.
Right-handed.
Yeah, he's got the yips. He has the yips.
So does Matt.
Yeah, yeah. Me too. I chip right-handed now and I putt right-handed. He chips right-handed, but I didn't do it because of yips. He did it because of yips.
And to all a good night.
Yeah. Guys, thank you so much. So great to be with you. I love that we have mutual respect and we learned from each other, and the passion for tennis is very much alive in this foursome. Thank you for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code MOM.